Welcome to Special Sauce, SiriusXM's podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
The goal is not the biggest possible audience. The goal is the smallest possible audience. So if you can build a restaurant on 1,000 people and make a living, then obsess about making a restaurant for 1,000 people. By focusing on what they need and delighting them, they're going to tell their friends.
Today, we welcome the delightfully uncategorizable, I would say, Seth Godin. Seth is a best-selling business author, an insanely popular blogger, a technologist, an entrepreneur, a serious eater, and one of our truly original thinkers. On so many subjects, marketing, leadership, starting businesses, Seth started a company, Yoyodyne, in 1992, which he sold to Yahoo in 1998. That company introduced the world to the notion of permission marketing, a concept still as relevant today as it was then. His book, Tribes, is a heraldic book about leadership that I wish I had read before I started Serious Eats. Today, Seth is still thinking radical thoughts. How many books now, Seth?
Well, I'm counting like 18.
18. Wow, man. Welcome, Seth Godin, you guru, you. Wow, it's so great to have you.
Well, I feel like such a faker because the people who have come before me on this show have done things with frying pans and knives that I could only dream of. So thank you for slipping me in on the side door.
That's it. That's all right. We use butter knives, too. So tell us, first of all, we have so many things I want to ask you about, but we have to hear about life at the Godin family table growing up.
I learned a lot there from two amazing parents, but a couple of things I would highlight. My mom regularly had 20 or 30 people over for dinner.
What do you mean regularly?
Like not just Thanksgiving and—
Once a month?
Yeah. That, you know, she was involved in the museum in Buffalo. And if someone was in from out of town, an artist or a sales rep, they were eating dinner at my house. And my dad would regularly have his business associates. He had a lot of Russian immigrants who worked for him, and they would come over two or three times a year, you know, with their cigarettes and the Russian and the vodka. And what was extraordinary was there was never, ever panic or hysteria. That she was a working mom, and at 5 o'clock she'd come home and start making dinner, and it was on the table because it was a joy to do it. It wasn't something where she felt like she was at risk.
So she didn't feel conflicted. She just was like, this is what I do.
Exactly. And that was one thing. The other thing was she couldn't make Jell-O or minute rice. And she was a really good cook, but Jell-O and minute
rice. But I think that's a sign of being a really good
cook. Exactly. And I learned a lot from that. And then the other thing is she made chocolate chip cookies that were amazing. But the thing about them was she always burned them. And I realized that she always burned them because she had the worst baking sheets in the world, and they were really old. And so one of the lessons that I took away was buy good tools.
Yeah.
Because she wasted a lot of chocolate chip cookies instead of... But, you know, so I grew up with two parents who believed that their kids should contribute and should lead and should fail on the way. Most moving for me was when I was 14. My dad got asked to go on a boat, like a 25-foot motorboat, across Lake Erie with this guy who was on the board of the company he worked for. My dad hated boats. He said, my son will go. So I'm on the boat with this strange guy, and we're headed for Detroit. I got a ticket home, US Air. Well, this guy's an idiot. We run out of gas, and we have to get rescued by the Coast Guard.
In the middle of Lake Erie?
In the middle of Lake Erie in a storm. We have to get rescued by the Coast Guard. I've been throwing up for a day and a half. Long story short, advance. I've been sick for a day and a half. Finally, we get towed in, and we're not in Detroit. We're in Cleveland. And at 11 o'clock at night, he drops me off in 1974 at the subway downtown Cleveland, not a safe place to be, hands me a $20 bill and just walks away, 11 o'clock at night. I take the subway to the airport, and there's only one hotel open. I check in. I call my parents. They're freaking because I wasn't on the plane that I was supposed to be on. And I say, hey, don't worry, I'm fine. I'm at the Hilton. I'll fly back tomorrow morning. And at 6 a.m., the phone rings. It's my mom. She's like, you're in Cleveland, because I had forgotten to say that we were in Cleveland. She thought she'd called every Hilton in concentric circles. So I get home at 11 o'clock in the morning. My clothes are covered with dried vomit. I haven't eaten or slept. My mom greets me at the airport, hands me a fresh change of clothes, and takes me to school. And she says, "You're not sick."
That's awesome.
And it was such a lesson. It's like, it's not a tragedy. It's not a disaster. You learned some really cool lessons. What's next?
It's so interesting the way you, that one of the three words you mentioned is failure. And it's a word that, you know, business bloggers, writers, corporate types, technologists don't often acknowledge and utter. And yet you're very, very free with the word in your writing and in your speeches. You obviously think that it's an important, essential component of living.
Yeah, you know, I think there are two ways to look at the world. Some people think you are ordained, that you are born with a certain set of genes or some angel over your shoulder, and what you do is what you do. And other people believe, and I am in the second group, that given the right culture and support and education, you can accomplish an enormous amount. That Vincent van Gogh wasn't born to paint. If he had been born 100 years earlier or later, he would have done something else. So if you believe in this possibility, then you have to say to yourself, well, why aren't more people contributing? Why aren't more people achieving their goals? And it seems to me that there are two reasons. One, that there's societal barriers that weigh some people down. They start 100 yards behind everybody.
Socioeconomic, whatever.
Exactly. And the second reason is because we don't know what to do with our fear. And if our fear paralyzes us, we end up as a senseless bureaucrat. If our fear paralyzes us, we settle for less. So my work is about helping people see that it's possible, realize that we're living during a revolutionary time, and honestly confront the fear. Because you can't make the fear go away, but you can learn to dance with it.
Is it fair to say that attacking the other problems, the socioeconomic problems that prevent people from realizing their full potential, is more problematic?
Well, I wouldn't say I mostly focus on the fear. Mm-hmm. I try to address both. The question, the challenge that we have when we start talking about bias and racism and institutional barriers is if we get too pointed and publish a screed, it's easy for people to dismiss us. So my job in both areas is to get under people's skin, to plant the seeds in little ways or big.
You're a welcoming provocateur, aren't you?
I'm trying to do that. You know, so for 20 years, every time I use a pronoun in writing for someone who has power, authority, and good taste, I use the female pronoun. And I've gotten hassled for that by a lot of people. But I think that showing up that way, putting a woman on the cover of my last book, talking about how we create role models, helping to build media companies around folks who don't look like you or me, these acts are how we layer on new levels of our society. Yes, it's really important that there are people who are brave enough and bold enough to stand up and say it straight up. And I applaud those people. But what I'm trying to do with all of my work is that other one, is get under their skin, drip by drip, day by day, model a behavior that works and also leaves behind a positive trail.
It's interesting because when, you know, I told you I gave a talk at my alma mater, Grinnell College, recently, and I had a copy of Tribes with me. And then I went out for coffee and then for dinner with students, and they were really interested in both your book and my talk, which basically amplified and expanded upon some of your basic tenets. I mean, I feel like we're kind of separated at birth because I've been talking about these things without even knowing how much time you've devoted to them in the last 25 years. But anyway, there was one woman who really worried that it was all well and good for me to talk about pursuing passions and disrupting. I could tell she was like, I have $100,000 in student loans. I'm about to graduate. I'm the first person in my family to goes to college. This is all well and good for you, but how does it relate to me?
Yeah, I love that. Well, let me tell you a college story from a couple years ago. I gave a speech. I wrote a book. It's free online called Stop Stealing Dreams. And it's sort of about how the educational industrial establishment is letting us down and under pressure at the same time. And at the end of the talk, this woman who was the senior vice president of a community college raised her hand and she said, well, it's all fine and good for you to talk about this and about how people have opportunities and we need to let them expand. But let me tell you something, mister. We have to let everybody into my institution. And now I'm going to give you an exact quote. She said, and those people are never going to make a difference. And on stage, I started to cry. Because here's this woman who was charged with opening doors for people, and she was slamming a door in their face before they even had a chance. And so what I would say to that woman who's in debt is don't slam the door in your own face. That, yes, you are in debt, but the good news is when you're in enough debt, the bank doesn't own you, you own the bank. And if you can figure out how to dig in deep and do work that matters, you'll be able to do it again tomorrow. And then you're on a path to do work that matters, and the debt will take care of itself. On the other hand, if you show up at 22 and say, tell me what to do, because I can't take initiative because I'm in debt, you're going to be saying that for the rest of your life.
Right. How did this thinking of yours evolve? Did you get it from your parents? Did you get it from reading? Did you get it from experience? Some combination of all of them?
You know, Buffalo, New York is a really cool place to grow up. It's not a big town, but it shares a lot in common with big towns. It used to be one of the five most important cities in the United States. It has a huge Polish population, a big Black population. My dad was on the board of the Baptist Church, the Black Baptist Church in town. My mom was on the board of the Albright Knox Museum. But we weren't rich. We just lived on the middle-class street, right? And so I got to see through their eyes why and how you show up and say, yeah, I'll volunteer to run the United Way. And I got to see the people that my dad worked with, UAW workforce, what someone is capable of doing who doesn't even have a high school education but wants to make a difference. And I was reminded every day that we won the lottery, right? That we were the ones who had grandparents and great-grandparents who made it easier for us to do this work. And never once was I told we deserved anything. We didn't. We don't deserve anything. But if we're lucky, we get to contribute something.
Right. Just as in real life, people that win the lottery don't always have happy endings.
Almost never, actually.
Right? But winning the lottery means that you believe in the possible.
Yeah.
You know, and that I used to say about Grinnell, where I just was, that I loved it there because the air was pregnant with possibility. And I felt in reading Tribes and reading some of your blog posts that one of the things you're really trying to talk about is that the air really is pregnant with possibility, even when it seems like you're suffocating.
Yeah. You know, one of the great things about your podcast is one after another, you have guests who are not short order cooks in a diner, right? That every single one of them has decided to take short order diner cook backgrounds and turn them into things that make change happen. And why are they able to make change happen when just down the block from where you and I are sitting, there's a guy who's been making scrambled eggs every day for 40 years? They started in the same place, right? Mm-hmm. Why did one go off to build an empire of 20 restaurants or change the culture or whatever it is? Because they saw that the changes in our world are going to discomfort some people and open doors for others. And those choices belong to all of us. What will we do with that open door? Because it won't be open forever. But you have a keyboard, I have a keyboard, everyone with a smartphone has a keyboard. That keyboard connects us to a billion other people. That video camera connects us to a billion other people. That's never been true before.
Right.
So I saw that revolution before almost anybody in 1989. And in 1991, I started an email company when no one had email. And I said,
wait a minute, that's not so smart.
At the time, it was stupid. But what I saw was that we are going to reshuffle media. And when you reshuffle media, it means that you can reach people and talk to people and connect people and elevate people and engage with people for free if you have something to say.
It's true. That's fascinating on two fronts. Number one, it was the basis for me starting Serious Eats. Pushing send,
right.
I had the same distribution as Condé Nast.
Exactly.
And when I would explain that, people are like, what do you mean? It's like the same. It's the great leveler.
Exactly.
But you have to have something to say. And so, you know, the internet has made everyone a pundit, right? And it means that everyone has a platform. But it's a little bit like Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park in London. You know, some of the people have something to say and some of them don't.
Let's be clear for one sec, though, Ed. If you look at the statistics, almost everyone on Twitter, for example, is a retweeter, not a tweeter.
Yeah.
That almost everyone in Hyde Park is listening to people on the platforms, not speaking. So it's tempting to think that everyone's a pundit. But in fact, almost everyone's a ditto head. Almost everyone's just saying what that guy said.
Right.
And for me, a key part of my mission is to say to people in the back row with their arms folded who don't ask questions at the end of the speech, you have the right, you have the ability, and you have the responsibility to be a pundit. Because otherwise, democracy goes away. Otherwise, the revolution is wasted.
Yeah.
And we've been brainwashed by 12 or 16 years of school to ask, will this be on the test? Instead of to ask, how can I contribute?
Right. So what you're really talking about is what technology gives us. And because this is podcast is sometimes about the world of food, I want to know what your observations are in terms of how technology has affected the world of food or the food culture.
Yeah. So the first thing that's easily overlooked is what technology did for the homosexual community, for gay men and women. And what it did was it showed you that you were not alone. What it did was show you there were other people like you. And that was the key turning point in the gay marriage movement, is that once we could see there were other people who, right? So the same thing happens in food, that there was no Thai food in New York City in 1968, right? I remember going with my Uncle Harris for Thai food in 1969, and I thought it was Czechoslovakian food, but now that I think back, it must have been Thai,
right?
But now we can see the other ones. And once you can see the other ones, the ideas spread faster. Once someone, Squirrel in L.A., comes up with a new kind of toast with avocado in it, every single chef who cares knows about it the next day.
So it's the viral nature.
Exactly. And so it levels up, it levels up, it levels up. And it's no longer sufficient, if you want to play in that world, to say we're just like we were 20 years ago. We were a butterball turkey. Butterball turkey is irrelevant now. Because the word has spread. I want a free-range, vegan, upside-down turkey, blah, blah, blah. And so in all of these ways, you know, Sir Kensington just got bought for hundreds of millions of dollars. What's wrong with ketchup? What's wrong with Hellman's mayonnaise? Why do we need another one? The reason we need another one is that we're human beings and we crave novelty and we crave connection. And we weren't finding novelty and connection from Heinz.
Right,
so we
even
went
though
somewhere
that's
else.
An excellent ketchup.
It's the best ketchup because it's the ketchup we grew up with.
Right.
You know, Malcolm Gladwell has famously said that the reason people have such a connection to ketchup is it's the first food we were able to apply ourselves, right? The first condiment that gave you the bottle, right? But now that we're moving past that, and we're moving past that in our main course, in our dessert, in our gluten-free, dairy-free, kosher muffins, whatever it is, the cycle is going faster and faster and faster until we use it up and then we go on to the next thing.
Right.
And in fact, sometimes it happens so fast that before the place is even open, it's passé, right?
Right.
Because we've snapped it and Instagrammed it so many times in preview. So it used to be a movie would run for 6 months. Now a movie lasts 4 days. And the reason is all the people who were even thinking that they might be going to the movie found out about it already and went already, or they're never going to go. And so these cycles keep continuing. Now, what does that mean to the typical person? It means that if you are not the creator of novelty, you're going to be the victim of novelty. Because if you're sitting there working at the Remington razor blade factory, it's not a steady job. And the reason it's not a steady job is because we've just switched to Dollar Shave Club. And so you're, you know, men are still going to have whiskers, but they're not going to necessarily use the same razors.
Right.
And so over and over again, we see, you know, Tesla is worth more than the Ford Motor Company. How can that be? Well, the reason it can be is because one is moving fast and the other one isn't.
Right. The other is by definition, trying to play catch up.
There you go. It's very hard to do in a culture that's based on novelty.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And it is so true in the food world when you think about things like ramen, pork buns,
yeah,
you know, avocado toast. You're right. It's like the woman at Squirrel, Jessica, I think is her name. She's like, avocado toast. And then all of a sudden, you know, now at the we're in Industry City now, there's an avocado toast restaurant.
There you go.
Exactly. You know, and you're right. It might be passé by next Saturday.
Right. Or you think about, you know, Ivan shows up in Japan, and for a Gaijin to make ramen in Japan was alien. Ramen, a food that didn't exist in Japan until it came over from China 100 years. I mean, so even in a country that's known for tradition, we're seeing that change creates winners and it creates losers. And I'm not minimizing the impact on the losers at all. What I'm saying to people before they become a loser is, you have the same keyboard. You have the same video camera. What are you going to do? And they say, well, I don't have any good ideas. And I say, well, you know what? The reason is you don't have any bad ideas. And if you could have more bad ideas, I guarantee you some good ideas are going to slip in.
Before we go on, today's sponsor is Audible, a really cool app that offers an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazine and newspaper publishers, and business information providers. They are now offering Special Sauce listeners, that's all of you, a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/SeriousEats and browse the selection. Then download a title, free, and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/SeriousEats. That's audible.com/SeriousEats and get started today.
This engine of change creates winners and it creates losers.
If we try to apply this thinking to people in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania where there was this huge manufacturing culture, they don't know that the keyboard is a path to possible freedom.
What does no mean? I think that they know in the sense that they've seen it happen to their neighbors. They've seen the world around them change. It's that they don't believe it's their turn, that they're not entitled, that they're not picked, that they're not authorized, that they've been raised to be a consumer, that we live in a country where we spend more money on self-storage than on going to the movies. It's a multi-billion dollar industry to store our stuff. That's what we got trained to do, buy stuff and put it away. So somebody, and that's people like you and me, are showing up anywhere where there's an electronic signal and say, you know what? Kickstarter shows us, and Twitter shows us, and Snap shows us, but non-technical things show us as well. You can actually go do this. There are third wave coffee shops in Detroit and in Shaker Heights and in Pennsylvania. There are cycles going forward. I can walk into a supermarket in Maryland and buy gluten-free organic granola. How'd that happen? Who made it? Right? Someone did. So this isn't about New York versus the rest of the world, LA versus the rest of the world. This is about human beings, and I hear from them every day from all over the world, deciding to say, follow me. And so, you know, today I got notes from South Africa, Turkey, India, and Korea from human beings who are living in places that aren't San Francisco, who aren't building public companies, who say, I have this following. I started a co-working space and now 20 people come here every day. Or I am leading social change in this little village in South Africa and we are building a school, right? That has never happened before in our lifetimes. It won't happen 50 years from now because the revolution will be over. But this connection revolution is changing everything. And when we look back at it, we're going to say, I can't believe we wasted so much time.
That's interesting because what you're saying is actually what I experienced at Serious Eats, because when you read most of the business press, it's all about Facebook and YouTube and Snapchat. And, you know, a book that you told me to read, Rework, talks about how they hate the word startup and that people don't launch startups. They start something.
There you go.
And there's a big difference. So talk a little bit about that, you know, when it comes to things like Sir Kensington or all the things that you've been exposed to and that you've been promoting all this time.
So here's the most important idea, and I've never heard anyone else say it, so I'll take credit for it. And I think it particularly is appropriate in the food business, but in many businesses. The goal is not the biggest possible audience. The goal is the smallest possible audience. So let me tell you what I mean by audience. I mean people who are engaging with you, who would miss you if you were gone. At a restaurant, people who are paying money. But by possible, I don't mean numerically possible, because that would be one. I mean that you can live in, that you can live with, that you can live for. So if you can build a restaurant on 1,000 people and make a living, then obsess about making a restaurant for 1,000 people. Because if you can't persuade 1,000 people, you're going to fail anyway. But if you can, by focusing on what they need and delighting them, they're going to tell their friends. And that's how you get to 2,000 and 5,000. So when Jason built Basecamp, which he writes about in Rework, their focus was, what's the smallest number of people who could use a piece of software and we could still have a company? How do we make those people happy?
Right. It's like almost reverse scaling.
Exactly. And I think that's what Serious Eats is. I think that's what
it was.
It's what Chowhound was at its peak, right? It's not for everybody. In fact, it's almost for no one, but that's enough.
Right, right. Well, it actually was for one person, getting back to your point. It was for me. It was like, how could I build a company that I wanted to be a part of
right. And
that I could live with and in? But I never thought of it like that. But it's true. And I thought I was a little crazy for thinking that that was what I was doing.
But in fact, with a few exceptions in San Francisco, that's where they all come from, right? That being an entrepreneur is not this clever plan, like going to medical school for 10 years and then you can be a dermatologist. Being an entrepreneur is, I have no choice. I'm unemployable. I want a change to happen in the world. I care enough about what I'm doing to say I'm doing it, because there's no net. That's crazy.
Right. My brother used to tell you, who just died and who was an investor in Series C, said that my wife and I lived our entire adult lives without a net.
Yeah. And what else could be better?
It all depends if you fall.
Well, for me, the way you live without a net is you make sure you're never too high off the ground.
Yeah.
Right? That what I've done since my very tough early days starting out is made sure that there was always the thing just below me that I had finished, so that if this next step didn't work, I could always go one step back. No one's asking you to go up 10 steps at a time, right? No one said, hey, Ed, let's start Serious Eats and hire 50 people tomorrow.
Right.
Right? It was, there's one person who's tweaking his way through something on Six Apart, right? And then the next thing, and then the next thing. And eventually, you got 50 or 100 or whatever it is people. But you got there step by step, building your own net. There wasn't some giant cushy net under all of us.
I built Serious Eats one set of eyeballs at a time.
That's right. And mostly, you weren't combating Condé Nast. You were combating yourself.
Right.
You were fighting with yourself to get back to the truth of what you were seeking to do. That if you had known what to do, you could have built the whole thing in 6 weeks, right?
Instead of 10 long years.
But because it was 10 years of figuring out how to get out of your own way to do the thing you should have done all along.
Yeah. Why is there been this explosion of food entrepreneurs, not just restaurateurs and chefs, but the Sir Kensingtons? And now it's funny, and we'll get to this in a second, I almost feel like there's more possibility in making stuff than there is in food media. So talk a little bit about why there's been this explosion of products and people making caramels or
sure. Fish
sauce or whatever.
Well, it's a bunch of things at once. The first thing I'll say is if you ever go to a meeting where you're talking about your company's logo, everyone has an opinion. If you go to a meeting and talk about server design or databases, no one speaks up. But logos, everyone speaks up. Food is the same way. Everyone has an opinion about
food. It's true.
So it feels safe to go into the food business because you know what you're talking about.
Right.
Because you eat, right? and therefore, a whole bunch of businesses that would be way better to go into from a business point of view are just sitting there lying fallow. But food is overfilled at all times because everyone thinks they know they have something to contribute. That's the first thing. Second thing is the difference between a prototype caramel or a prototype mayonnaise and the finished one is very small. So you can make the prototype in your kitchen, which almost everyone has a kitchen, which is not the same as, say, an app. If you want to build an app, you really can't do it by yourself, and it's a lot of work, whereas this is just what you made for dinner last night, doing it again, right? So again, there's an ease of entry thing. But then the third part, which we talked about earlier, which is that the internet is a broadcast medium, not just for music now, but food is the new music, and Instagram is the new radio for food.
Right. My friend Zach Brooks has a blog called Food is the New Rock.
There you go.
A podcast.
Right. So instead of starting a rock band, you start a mayonnaise company. And you can certainly find a packer to do it for you. And there's all this new distribution. Because what we did was, you know, A&P had an 80-year run, and then they hit the wall. Because we don't need more average stores selling average food to average people. We've solved that problem. So if you want to grow in food distribution and sales, you got to sell weird stuff to weird people. And, you know, a quick walk through Brooklyn, there's a store that only sells mole, and there's a store that only sells meat, and there's a...
Right, there's a kombucha superstore.
Exactly, because that is the only... If you want to just be the average bodega, we already have the average bodega. You need the new... Well, those people all need a food entrepreneur. So I would say John Scharfenberger was there in early on this.
Right, this is Scharfenberger Chocolates.
Exactly. So he was in the wine business. He decides to be the first bean-to-bar chocolate maker in the United States. And he says, I know, we'll sell to chefs because chefs have good taste. We have something that tastes good. No chef would buy it.
Exactly.
Because chefs don't really have good taste. They just want something that works. Get out of my way.
Right.
They took some leftovers to the Berkeley Farmers Market. And they brought 8 hours worth and it sold out in 20 minutes. And that was the win.
Yes, for sure.
Because at the farmer's market, you need a new thing. And he had one.
Exactly. And I actually spent a lot of time. I was going to write a chapter for a book about Robert Steinberg, who was John's partner.
Yeah, the doctor.
The doctor who died very tragically of cancer a long time after he got the diagnosis, interestingly enough. And the reason he went from doctoring to chocolate was like, if I'm going to die, I'm going to do something I love.
There you go.
And, you know, so he was a Seth Godin acolyte without even knowing it. But it's true that this explains some of the changes, but it also means that there are still going to be failures.
Oh, yeah. There's a ton more than ever.
Talk a little bit about the role that failure plays in your thinking and that people might experience. I mean, I confronted failure way too often in the life cycle of Series C's before I sold it.
So most people don't want to fail because if you fail in school, you get in trouble. If you fail in your job, you get fired. If you fail while driving, you crash. Failure and death are one step apart. But Pablo Picasso painted 10,000 paintings, and only 100 of them were amazing, right? Only 50 of them changed the world, which means he failed 9,900 times. That Miles Davis made dozens and dozens and dozens of records, and more than half of them were way below average. That if you look at any menu that a Mario Batali or Danny Meyer has put in front of the world, most of the dishes won't be around.
They're fine.
They're going to take them off the menu soon because they failed, right? That what it means to be an artist, and I use this word very carefully, is to do work that matters in a human way and change someone else. We are artists if we are doing this work, and artists fail for a living. That's what we do. John Cage had 5 amazing pieces of work. That's it, in a lifetime, 5. So we fail the rest of the time. If you want to do this work, you have to sign up to fail. You have to create a structure where you get to fail more than once. But
right, that's the key. Yeah, and because one of the things that always scared me about Serious Eats was because I started this, my first entrepreneurial venture, really, at the age of 54. Right. And so I was like, I don't know that I'm going to get to fail many more times at this level. Right. With other people's money.
Yep.
As soon as you introduce the idea of other people's money, then the cost of failure goes way up.
Well, Emotionally, it goes.
Yes,
down.
That's what I mean. Emotionally,
right? It turns out that it's fun at some level to start a business with someone else's money, but it is not required. And so you can fail at that, and then maybe you have to do your next project without someone else's money. But it doesn't change anything about failure. So my history, I mean, one of my first businesses was as a food entrepreneur, 76, when I was 16 years old, selling ice cream sandwiches at the school cafeteria. Then when I was in college, we started 30 different businesses, my partner and I, including a bagel delivery service, a birthday cake delivery service. So I got food way back in my genes. And most of the projects that I've started, and I have a blog post that I did 3 years ago, 30 years of projects. And on those projects, there's stuff you never heard of. There's stuff that didn't launch. There's stuff that failed. I'm super proud of every one of them because I have failed more than you. That's my mantra. If I can fail more than you, I win.
Yeah, that's so interesting, and yet it's so rarely uttered because people are so afraid of the word failure and what it implies and what the ramifications of it are for their lives.
That's right. Now, there's this thing going on the internet, Failure Olympics, which is intentionally failing, putting people into miserable situations to practice failing. I hate this because it's not real. It's fake. What real failure is failing in the service of generosity. Meaning, if you seek to change someone for the better, seek to contribute to a market, and it doesn't work, that's a good failure.
So if Roy Choi and Daniel Patterson fail with local, that's a noble failure, the most noble failure. And you know, we could argue all day whether Pete Wells is right when he negatively reviewed local, or Jonathan Gold is right when he called it Restaurant of the Year. But it does talk about intent, you know, much more than anything else. And there's sort of a virtuous intent.
Yes. And that's why Schadenfreude is such a horrible emotion, right? This is a German word for it. I wish there was an English one, of the joy we feel in someone else's failure. And certainly there's Schadenfreude when you see a high-flying restaurateur get too big for his britches and spend too much money and it goes down and everyone's like, good on him that he failed. But I think if we can avoid that and put that emotion instead to, well, what tiny contribution could I make today that might not work? That's what makes it worth doing. It might not work. And let's see what happens. And it doesn't have to be big to change things. It could be the tiniest little thing. That, you know, I've been talking to Danny Meyer about his tipping policy, which is such a heroic move on his part. For people who aren't aware, at his restaurants like Union Square Cafe, there's no tipping. It's built into the price. But the internet hates this because the internet is a sort by price medium, meaning if you look at menus, he's going to come down lower because his price is built in. So that's why the airlines are so terrible, because they keep lowering what appears to be the price to win on Hipmunk and Orbitz. So the question is, should other restaurant owners go along with what he's doing or hope that he will fail? And for me, it's really clear that going along with what he's doing helps everyone in a really profound way. And I'm hoping that he'll stick it out long enough to do it. But even if he fails, his act of doing it is clearly from a place of generosity. And that bravery is what we look for from our leaders. And who better to lead us than people who are saying, I'm doing something, follow me.
Right. Speaking of leadership, I was so affected by Tribes. And I realized, I think I told you when we had lunch, that it's like, I wish I'd read your book, because I didn't realize that that's what I was doing with Serious Eats.
Exactly.
But I really was forming a tribe. And it was actually two tribes. The first tribe was the people that worked there. Mm-hmm. And the second tribe was the people who read it.
Right.
You know, and I was connecting those two and hope that there was a resonance there.
Yeah.
Right. And isn't that all any of us can do, really, in the end?
Well, you know, it feels like we still have the shot to be industrialists behind the scenes, holding the strings, having marionettes, and just collecting a lot of money. You know, I knew a guy who was a wholesale plumbing distributor in New Jersey, and he was doing fine, right? That model, 1950s model, is fine. But if you go down to Superiority Burger, the tribe is there. They're hanging out. They recognize each other. If you walk through an airport just 5 years ago and you have the new iPhone or the new iPad or the new Mac, people give you that little head shake. Like, what do we have in common exactly? Just a machine, but it's more than a machine. It's people like us. So if I was going to remarket Tribes as a marketing book, it would be a 6-word book, and it would say, people like us do things like this. That might be 7 words. People like us do things like this. That's what Serious Eats was. You were the piano player in Sam's Place. You were the piano player giving people a rhythm. People like us cook like Kenji. People like us eat in places like this. And that rhythm is something that we aspire to. We don't want to do what everyone is doing, but we want to do what people like us are doing. That's who we are.
Yeah, that's so, so interesting. You obviously think that technology had many positive effects on the culture, affords us all opportunities that we wouldn't have had otherwise. But what about the flip side when it comes to responsibility?
Yeah, I have had fights with my friends in Silicon Valley about this. You know, Kevin Kelly, brilliant writer, wrote a book called What Technology Wants. There is something called the technology ratchet, which is that technology makes us want more technology. And that's one reason why it keeps going. But it is not true that it can only go in one direction. It can go in a lot of directions, and it's up to us. We are not absolved of responsibility. We are completely responsible for the technology that goes into the world and how it is used. Just look at income distribution. Technology could create more equitable income distribution, but left to its own devices with some selfish people, it could just as easily create 100 monopolies that put all the houses on Park Place and Boardwalk. That's not okay. It's not okay for the people who are left out. And in the long run, it's not even okay for the people who are hoarding, because when the Gini index gets too big, people are going to have horrible things happen. That when we use technology to enable race-blind hiring, that's a good thing because it enables not just diversity, but asset utilization. It's socially the right thing to do. But when we use technology to make it easier to pre-screen people based on their economic standing or their racial background, we've hurt ourselves in the long run. So I don't think anyone has the right to say, it's not me, it's the computer.
Right.
It's Google can't say, it's the algorithm.
Right.
It's their damn algorithm.
Right. And Facebook can't say, we're not creating the fake news.
Yeah, exactly. I think being on the hook is the only place to be. And we're on the hook whether we admit it or not, so we ought to act like we're on the hook.
But the question becomes for companies like Facebook and Google is that when they're faced with the economic ramifications, mm-hmm. being that they're publicly held, then what those ramifications are sort of stop them from taking responsibility and changing because they're afraid it's going to affect their bottom line,
well,
correct?
Well, maybe. Okay, so first of all, Milton Friedman, no fan of his, was wrong.
Free market economist, University of Chicago.
Yeah, and it's worth saying the Nobel Prize in Economics is a fake Nobel Prize. It was invented 70 years after the other ones. But anyway, he said that the only purpose of a company is to make a profit for its shareholders. That's just not true. We gave organizations the privilege to be companies. They have many constituents, not just their shareholders. Going public is a choice. And when you go public, it comes with rights and responsibilities. The stock market, Wall Street, is an idiot. All it wants is short-term quarterly results. And as a result, they have driven many great companies into the ground because those companies are driving through the rearview mirror, trying to make tomorrow a little better. But the thing about Google and the thing about Facebook is they are both controlled completely by the people who run them. And they are not off the hook. They have made these choices and they should live with them. Here's why they don't. There are 10,000 people in those companies who have stock options, who every day are looking at the stock price. And if the stock price goes up a dollar, some of those people made $100,000 in one day. So when you make a choice that makes the stock price go down in the short run, you have to look around the conference room and realize you just cost those people $2 million. And I think, fine, because they could go work somewhere else. But if you're going to go to work with your talent and your privilege and your leverage, then go to work for the reason you said you were going to go to work, not to make Wall Street happy.
Right.
And I feel really strongly about this. And watching Google make selfish short-term decisions really hurts me. because that's not what Sergey and Larry set out to do. If you read the original paper that they wrote, it's available online, they directly said they wanted to do the opposite of that.
Right. We're not evil.
Well, we're not evil was a euphemism for we're not Microsoft.
Right.
But they mostly were saying, as soon as you put ads in a search engine, you corrupt it. And our job is going to be to build something that's not corrupted by commercial interest. We're going to organize the world's information. And what they've done since then is around the edges shifted the way so many people act, like Serious Eats, like the companies I've started, to make Google happy, right? That shouldn't be the goal ever. The goal should be, how do we engage with people who want to be engaged with and deliver something they would miss if they were gone? Because if we all did that, then all the boats rise in a way that creates a vibrant connection economy. And we're on the verge of missing that.
Now, I wanted to ask you about sites like Yelp, you know, which have given everyone a voice, which restaurateurs sometimes hate and mm-hmm. sometimes love. It is an extension of democracy and people taking advantage of having a voice. But it's certainly, you could certainly make the case that it is, it has been corrupted, that not everyone should have a voice, or people should be able to discern which voices are which.
Yes. Here's the other thing to keep in mind, in addition to people like us, which is we're all weird. And single-axis sorts are never helpful. So if I said, what's the best article of clothing, we shouldn't have a vote, because bras for people who are 6'2" wouldn't win. Shoes for people who have size 3 feet wouldn't win. It would be, whatever, Converse sneakers. That just gets you to this weird middle that makes no one particularly happy. That single-axis voting doesn't give us room for pock-pock. It doesn't give us room for per se. It doesn't give us room for real sushi. It gives us room for refrigerated, almost frozen $2 California rolls, right? So the challenge that Yelp has is that it's used by most people incorrectly. It's used by most people to sort by stars. Who's near me and who's the best?
It's true. We had an editor at Serious Eats who's no longer with us who told me that her fiancé, now her husband, only went to restaurants that got at least, whatever, 4 stars or something from Yelp. And I was just like, that's really the way he decides the
exactly.
restaurants he goes to? I was just shocked and horrified by
right.
that.
It's like getting into a cab that's driven by a blind clown and saying, drive anywhere you want, I'll go there. Right? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So the technology needs nuance. It needs a way to be able to help us see 2 or 3 levels deep. And that's the problem with monolithic network effect sites, is that sooner or later, and this is why BuzzFeed gets so much traffic compared to The Atlantic. The Atlantic is way better for by any intellectual, thoughtful, honest measure, but BuzzFeed is optimized for a clicking mass.
Yes, and if that the founder of BuzzFeed, as I was told by somebody who knows him, I can't remember his
Jonah.
Name. Jonah was obsessed even when he was at MIT with what went viral.
Yeah.
That was because I said, I don't know what Jonah believes in. And this woman said, actually, Jonah has always been obsessed. What he believes in is what goes viral.
Right. Exactly. And that's a thing, but it's not the only thing. And so we're going to have to keep figuring out, gorillas like us below the radar, what do we build that doesn't go that way. So here's what I do. I don't read my reviews on Amazon. I have no idea what my traffic statistics are. I don't try to write bestsellers. By giving up those three things intentionally as a practice, I am determined to write quirky, semi-obscure stuff that people talk to each other about, as opposed to, I know how to write that other stuff. I used to do it. I don't want to do that because it doesn't stand the test of time. It doesn't make a difference, and no one would miss it if it was gone. So you and I are talking on 9th Avenue, and there are plenty of restaurants here that could disappear and be replaced by one sort of like them, and no one would notice. But then there are other places. I'll pick Amy's Bread, two blocks from here. She's been there forever.
Right.
And people would miss her if she was gone.
Yes.
I'm guessing she does not have great Yelp reviews, because if you go in there saying, I want a grilled cheese sandwich on Wonder Bread, she probably doesn't have it.
Right. And Amy, if I know her, is actually obsessed with quality and with satisfying herself, getting right back to your point.
Exactly.
Your wife is in the food business, right?
She's
a baker.
She has a baking empire with four bakeries.
And opened one in our neighborhood. And she introduced me to gluten-free desserts that didn't suck.
That's sort of the motto, except said more nicely. Exactly.
When your kids were growing up, was food an important thing in your house? Or do they feel passionately about food?
So my kids are super passionate about food. I cooked and still do dinner every single night. Not my wife, me. And it was my opportunity to be a full-time dad. So I get home at 3 o'clock, spend 2 hours with the kids, shopping, cooking, talking, because it's a great way, particularly when kids are teenagers, to have those conversations. And then in between, you know, driving to rock climbing or whatever. So we would have, you know, 3, 4, 5 course meals. Someone would be eating Thai food tonight. Someone's a vegan. Someone's only eating the left side of the animal. It would just always be food. And my eldest, we took him to a Thai restaurant when he was 27 days old. That was his first time out. And we would go, my two kids and I went to Tokyo for 3 days and had 15 meals while we were there. So food.
And they're still talking to you?
It was fabulous. So food is, for me, and one of the magics of this podcast is you talk about the impact that food had on people as a kid and how that's a trajectory for who they become. And I believe that. I think that's a profound insight on your part. And I determined that I wanted to help my kids journey that way. Because one of the things you learn when you eat weird stuff is that failure is okay. That we will get in the car, drive 45 minutes to a place in Queens that only serves one thing, and it's not very good. We don't say after that, we're never going to go to another restaurant again. We say, well, that was interesting, right? And so, you know, Legends of Taste. We go to Legends of Taste just on a hunch because Jim Leff said it was good. We go back the next night. We go back 4 days later. And now Jack, when we go back, welcomes us and makes us special.
It's a Chinese restaurant in
fabulous Szechuan place.
Yeah.
And that experience is not that different from, I'm going to launch a blog. Not that different from, I'm going to have a consulting company. Not that different from, there's a group for underprivileged kids in Boston. I'm going to volunteer to help run it this year. Because it's the same mindset, which is, it's only dinner. It's only a blog post. It's only a project.
Right.
And then let's cycle again.
Yeah.
So the origin story for my wife's bakery, which is called By the Way, is she was a workaholic lawyer for 25 years and ended her career at Bloomberg. And after she left, realized she wanted to see people, to connect in the community, to be part of something more earthy than intellectual property law. And started by looking at, you know, should it be soup? Should it be this? Should it be that? And realized long before it was a thing that gluten-free was up and coming. And that in all her tasting of gluten-free stuff, she couldn't find anything she liked. Now, here's the really interesting thing where the internet comes in again. What she did was she basically used her legal skills to have litigation of recipes. So she would make a recipe and then make an alternative one and compare them and try to figure out what was underneath them. And because all the recipes...
She was a little Kenji.
Exactly. And all the recipes are online now. You couldn't do that 20 years ago. So here's all the versions of gluten-free challah. Let's see what happens if we take from this. And so for a year, she sat in our kitchen and experimented. And now she's got 50 employees and a giant commissary in Pleasantville. It's extraordinary to see what she's built.
And are your kids still interested in food?
Yes. My eldest has a dinner party once a week for 8 or 10 people they sort of know. He and his roommate sort of know. He does an annual pig roast in Prospect Park for 100 friends once a year.
Wow.
And
Can we come?
I'll ask him if you're invited.
All right.
And my younger son doesn't quite have the audience for his cooking, but is... also deep into the food game. It's thrilling to watch the two of them develop their palates. They eat plenty of food I don't eat because I'm mostly a vegan. But, you know, if Alex wants to bring a pig head into his house, it's fine.
So, you know, I consider you one of our foremost futurists. Where do you think food is going?
Well, I think it's tempting and easy to take what we know today and just put some shininess on it for a year from now, but I'm going to be more daring than that. I think that it's interesting to note that there hasn't been a famine in a democracy in my lifetime. And I'm fearful that that's not going to be true for much longer. So we're going to have, because of atmosphere change, we're going to have significant issues with water and food and crop failure.
Even in democracies, even in democracies. Well-developed, yes. First, you know.
Exactly, because we're on a precipice there that's very scary. That's going to change the way people feel about going out for an $85 Thai meal, because once we don't have food sufficiency, stuff's challenging. At the same time, we are really close to growing meat in a test tube. And I think that once we do that, we're going to have food that didn't involve killing something that tastes a lot like meat because it is meat. And that's going to change a lot of supply chain stuff. That's going to change the cost of a lot of things.
Right, because right now the cost of raising cattle, you know, beef cattle is not sustainable.
Right. And then the third factor is the number of people who have grown up with blended food youth compared to the number of people who grew up with pierogi because they were Polish and, you know, wherever you're from. If you grew up with chicken fingers and grilled cheese sandwiches, the question is, where's your foundation? And how will modern food, as you enter adulthood, resonate with you if it can't riff on something from your childhood? Because soon, you know, 10 years from now, this podcast is going to have chefs on it who say, yeah, I grew up eating off the kids' menu at Applebee's. What do you do from that, right?
Right.
And so I think right now we're in this personality-driven thing, Anthony Bourdain times 10, famous chefs. That doesn't go forever. So what replaces it? And for people who are looking for food as entertainment, where does that go? And an analogy I'll give you is, what happened to Broadway after 1970? Because you could grow up with Broadway as entertainment and go regularly. After 1970, it switched to Broadway as spectacle, and it was for tourists. You didn't go as often. Okay, fine. Now where do we go? You get a Hamilton every once in a while, but it's not that vibrant thing it was.
Mm-hmm.
So that could happen to our New York-centric food world.
Or even the food-centric world
in general,
wherever.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think it's a crapshoot. It's a crapshoot. What happens if every single town has a Bouchon bakery? What do you do next, right? And so it's interesting. I hang out at City Bakery a lot on 18th Street, and Mari Rubin has been running. He had the first real salad bar, organic, green market salad bar. He makes these pretzel croissants, and you see the people who come in. You see that this is their home. That if he changed one sesame seed, there'd be an uprising. That's what food used to be about.
Right? Yes.
How do we build that feeling of mishpucha and family here?
And resonance.
And resonance. But going forward, once you've brandified it and industrialized
you remove the resonance.
Exactly. So we're entering this new post-resonance thing. Sometimes that'll lead to a backlash to the local restaurant with the real chef who you know.
And who's there.
Exactly. That's super special. But that's going to be a different kind of profession than someone who's making $7 million a year on a private jet because they're a famous chef.
Right.
So basically I'm saying I don't have a clue.
All right. I respect your honesty. So now it's time for the all-you-can-answer, special sauce buffet. So,
okay.
You know, we don't have any bells or anything rings. There's no music. Just, yeah, that's okay. Good. I like that. Who's at your last supper? No family allowed. And I don't, in most cases, I say, you know, it can be artists. But for you, I don't have to say that because your purview is so huge. You know, it could be living your dad, could be anybody. Four people.
Oh, boy. I'm completely unprepared
That's
for these
all right.
questions.
This is good.
That's why I did that on purpose.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that you want conversation. So you want people like Ben Franklin. You want people who have been through the ringer. So women like Sojourner Truth, people who have really had an experience coming through their life.
And talk about her for a second.
You know, go back to people in the 1800s and 1900s, the Harriet Tubmans, the suffragette movement, people who Madam C.J. Walker used to live down the street from me, first black millionaire in the United States. She invented the franchise. I'd love to have someone like that there. And then maybe David Mamet, but not this David Mamet, the David Mamet from 20 years ago, who has a sharp opinion. And then I need one graphic artist, so definitely Marcel Duchamp, the last living great artist.
Wow. Now that is an awesome Last Supper table. And what are you eating?
Well, I'm particularly rigid, and so I would cook, and it would involve a grain bowl with various organic toppings from the green market in June, I think, or maybe July.
And what would be for dessert?
By the way, bakery almond cookies.
I said no family allowed. I should have said no family goods allowed,
okay.
Too.
Well, then if it's for dessert, there is a... There used to be a wonderful raw restaurant in New York City that had a tragic end called Pure Food and
Wine.
Oh,
I remember that.
And the woman who baked there has escaped to the West Coast, I think Oregon, and she runs a bakery called Moon and Stars, I think. And she still makes the gluten-free raw brownie that I can find every once in a while in New York City, and I buy six of them.
Really? Actually a good gluten-free brownie?
Why would I buy six of them if it wasn't amazing?
That's true. So what do you cook when there's not much in your house to work with?
So I cook lunch for everyone in my office every day. And there's not a lot in the fridge because it's the office.
Right.
So some days it's dosas with various fillings, and the rest of the time, it's an extraordinary bowl of brown rice with rice wine vinegar. And then almost anything you put on top of it is a win, but often it'll be a free-range fried egg. Or lately it's been, you can take cashews and make them into a sauce. And everyone seems happy, even though I'm paying their salary. They could still complain, and they don't.
What, do you have guilty pleasures? Do you even believe in the concept of guilty pleasures?
When I was a chubby teenager, I sure did. I got home from school every day. I took out the pint of Sealtest chocolate ice cream we had, the cheap
Sealtest,
one.
Sealtest, I haven't heard that.
$1.99, the bag of rolled gold pretzel rods, and the jar of whatever industrial peanut butter my mom had in the house, and the box of Sun-Made raisins. So here's what you do. You take the pretzel rod, you dip it in the peanut butter, you roll it in the raisins, and you use it as a spoon to eat the ice cream. And you keep going until you run out of one ingredient.
That's so awesome.
I did that every day. And no, I no longer have any guilty pleasures. Sorry.
That's because you can live off those forever. So, who's the one person that you, and I should add the caveat that it's someone that you don't know, because you probably know a lot of folks, that you'd like to break bread with and just to hear how they think about the world and what they do?
I wrote a blog post 5 years ago called Mentors and Heroes. There's this thing going around where people send you a note saying, will you be my mentor? As if that's a okay thing to ask. And my response is, having a hero is way more important. The hero doesn't know you exist, but you can learn from them because you can say to yourself, what would this person do? What would this person do? And so I've tried to fill my life with heroes. And I've been really weirdly lucky that I've actually met some of them in real life, and they haven't let me down. But this notion that in this moment when there's so much pressure to do the short-term thing, that hero of mine, Gandhi, what would he do in this setting?
Right? Wow.
And I find it hugely helpful. So basically you're saying, which of my heroes would I want to sit down and talk with? Yeah, I'm going to say it's going to either be Nelson Mandela or Gandhi. And it's not because they're famous dead people. It's because in the moment for each of them of maximum pressure to just go along, they dug deeper than anyone else could have and stuck with something that mattered to them.
Yeah, it's true. So it's just been declared Seth Godin Day all over the world. What's happening?
Everyone's wearing socks that don't match.
Okay.
I haven't had matched socks for 12 years.
All right, that's good.
I think mostly it's a day for making a ruckus in a generous fashion, for doing something that might not work and doing it in a way that you're proud of.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I agree with that. Well, Seth, this has been such a pleasure. Thanks so much for sharing your special sauce with us. It's awesome that you're here. Read his always provocative blog. Check out any one of How many books?
I guess 18.
18. And if you're in New York and you have issues with gluten intake, or even if you don't, check out Seth's Wife's Bakery, by the way. I have. Finally, read Seth's book, Tribes. He wrote it 10 years ago, but I found it just as relevant this year when I had a chance to reread it. So long, Serious Eaters. We'll see you next time, and thank you so much, Seth.
Wow, what a pleasure. People don't know how much work you put into this, but I, for one, do, and I am thanking you on their behalf.
Thank you. I appreciate it.